Broadcasting on all frequencies from the jungle of death, you're listening to Babes in the Woods.
Hello, lovely listeners. Welcome back to the jungle of death. You're tuned in to our brand new, awesome primer episode of Babes in the Woods. I'm joined, per usual, by my super awesome and super fancy co-hosts. One Rachel Crouch.
Hello.
And one Nissa Clark.
Hello.
I am, as always, Lindsay Kronk. So ladies, we watched
this. You're not only sometimes Lindsay Kronk.
I am always Lindsay Kronk. I got married, decided not to change it. Even in an embryonic state, I was always Lindsay Kronk.
Always.
Yeah, this is me doing my embryo harms.
Oh, God.
Did you see on it, the most recent episode of Adventure Time, that they have embryo princess? It's hilarious.
You just look like you did T-Rex arms, which now makes me think of you as an embryonic T-Rex.
That I was hatched. I was not. I'm not a mammal.
Everything about life just got better.
Nothing like a mammal.
Not a mammal. So we watched this movie, Primer. And it's about time travel. It's a different take, sort I would say, of. On time travel than what we've historically seen. So I thought that a good sort of introduction before we delve into this crazy time travel extravaganza would be talking a little bit about our own time travel origins. What brings us here to this point in time? Was it a TARDIS?
I'm sorry.
Was it a DeLorean?
It was a DeLorean for me.
So tell us more.
I like you trying to guess off of my face, like which one was going to be the correct one.
Was it H.G. Wells's time machine, which mostly seems like the Frankenstein monster? Like electricity device, but attached to a sled.
Yeah, I feel like that's pretty accurate. Electricity is going to cause all kinds of problems. Let us speculate in all sorts of literature. The galvanized man.
So, I think that for me, my original time travel experience, which is kind of hilarious, was I didn't watch actually Back to the Future until I was maybe in sixth or seventh grade. I watched Quantum Leap, however, from a very young age, and I fell in love with Scott Bakula, and also the premise of trying to find your way back to the right spot in time with a time travel device that was malfunctioning in such a way that you were transported into random people.
Right, and it sort of hated you.
It's so stressful. Yeah. It's so stressful. At one point, he's like Marilyn Monroe's like bodyguard. At like another point, like he didn't encounter so many famous people that it became too gimmicky. But yeah, Quantum Leap was
very sometimes. Yeah,
was my first and in some ways still like most beloved time travel situation.
I love Quantum Leap.
Yeah,
also,
it's
every
great.
Every time I say "old boy," it is in reference to that show, but no one ever gets it.
I think it's so good, and like I just that intro sequence with him standing in that white suit with the blue flames all around him, and what's his face? I should have looked it up before the show, clearly, but his like computer companion.
Oh yeah, Sam.
Yeah.
No, Sam is
Sam's
the guy. Bakula.
The guy, yes.
His companion / sidekick is Al.
Al
Calabici.
That's it.
Yeah, it's so good. And oftentimes he had to sort of solve problems. And it was almost like a video game in that he had to solve the problem of whatever was going on before he could move on.
Yes.
So,
that's true, it is like a video game.
Right? Like, you gotta hit different levels before you can return to Sam.
There's the boss level, which is clearly the season finale.
Yeah, 100%. What about you, Nissa?
I don't know, thinking about, like, I never really thought about, you know, the first time I encountered time travel, because it's just one of those things that I feel like I've always known about.
Yeah.
In the same way that, like, there was no time when I was not going to be a nerd.
Never.
Like, never. So, like, I watched a lot of Quantum Leap when I was little, but also, like, Star Trek had, you know, a couple of time loop episodes
and
stuff like that. So, like, I'm not really sure what the first intro was. I also was quite old by the time I saw Back to the Future. I think I was in high school when I saw the first one, and I was, like, 25 when I saw the other two.
But as you may know by now, listeners, Nissa doesn't watch movies.
I try to. I feel like
you're
I
better
do
now.
Movies, but it's not kind of...
We have to, like, have our episodes that are about movies in order to get you to watch movies.
That's very true.
It's a little sad. It's not because I don't like movies. I just don't see them.
Yeah, no. But I will say that Back to the Future was notable to me on the AV Club, like, 2 years ago. Genevieve Kosky mm-hmm. wrote a really inflammatory piece that was about watching Ghostbusters for the first time at, like, age 24 and not thinking it was as awesome as, like, everyone else your own age thinks it is.
Oh, my God.
You know, as a result, like watching something like that too late. I did not have that same experience with Back to the Future. I watched it, realized it was totally awesome, and then it was something that was missing from my life.
Well, it's also, I feel like Back to the Future is one of those things that it so effectively puts you in the sort of, it sounds dumb to say the feeling, but, like, the sort of energy of the time that it came out. Like, it's a lot easier to put yourself in there, whereas Ghostbusters is definitely a product of its time, but it's much less iconic, I guess. Not that it's a less iconic movie, but, like, the whole, it doesn't,
it's not as comfortable a fit, maybe, for everyone. Maybe that's it.
I do believe there are movies that are amazing, but if you didn't grow up with them, don't try.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's true.
People who come back and tell me Labyrinth isn't, like, the greatest thing in the world.
I'm like, shut your face. Do you not have any sex drive? Because that's basically what it's about for me.
Yeah,
it's like,
that's
the sexy tension times.
Oh,
like,
man.
It's the sexiest movie ever made. It's not that, like, the, you know, like, anything happens, but, like, oh, Christ alive.
And
I don't even care about how inappropriate
like
it is.
Yeah.
I do not care. I do not care that she's 14 years old. I do not care.
So
I do not care about how sketchy it is. It's just, it's so beautiful. But Flumpy,
it is beautiful, though.
What about you?
For me, it was definitely the DeLorean in terms of Back to the Future, because I remember actually being pretty young and waiting in line to get tickets to see Back to the Future 3.
Oh, man.
Like, I remember I had watched 1 and 2. I loved Michael J. Fox. I had a huge crush on him.
I remember that.
And I also had a huge crush on him as Marty McFly. And so my grandparents, I remember, took me to go see Back to the Future 3, and I remember standing, it was like my first experience actually having to stand in line for such a long time to get tickets. We were afraid we wouldn't get tickets. And we went and saw Back to the Future 3, which is a big deal because it was shot at the same time as 2, which was like one of the first times that had been done.
Uh-huh.
But I love those movies. And I recently, while I was on a business trip, was in a hotel, and I couldn't access the internet, and so Back to the Future was on HBO. All 3 movies were on. I caught the last half of the first one. I caught all of the second one. I stayed up to watch most of the
Bully
third.
For you. That sounds great. Oh.
It was awesome.
Man, I
and
love.
I was sitting there with, like, whole food,
yeah.
Like, because I have to eat
out. Yeah. Yeah, dude, because you're out on a business trip. So you're alone in the fanciest hotel room you'll probably ever be in by yourself, right? And then, like, you go and you get, like, a 6-pack. Or, like, a bottle of wine. I always do this. And then I get in my room tipsy, watching whatever's on TV, and it feels so luxurious. I love it. I love business trip evenings, not knowing anyone in a place, and thereby feeling unmoved to communicate with anyone.
Yeah. Well, and it was great. I think the other thing that was kind of cool is...
You need to get a business trips job.
Yeah.
Yeah, you really need to get a business trips job.
Yeah.
But watching the first one, I was reminded of how little of it takes place in the 80s. So I think that might also be why it doesn't feel like as much
That's
of a product
true.
Of its time.
As much of a period
piece.
So much
piece. Of it's a flashback.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's interesting, too, because, you know, like, certainly there's an optimism about 80s movies, but I think that one of the things that makes Back to the Future so, like, whiz-bang, you know, like, and, like, joyful is the fact that it takes them back to the 50s, and then it corrects what's wrong. With the 80s in the process, right? Like, everything is fixed, and, like, his father's a science fiction author, and his mom is totally satisfied. The happy ending at the end of Back to the Future is one of those all-time cinematic highs, I think, where you just walk out and you're just like, yeah, we can't fix what's wrong.
Like, polishing the car.
Yeah, no, I think it's, that's actually part of the reason I think it's such an interesting counterpoint to Primer. Because, you know, like, you have these two very different ideas of, like, what you do when given this tremendous power.
All
and
right.
what Marty does with it, you know, is, like, try to fix what's wrong in his parents' relationship. Like, it's very small scale, but it does have a huge impact in his personal life. Like, you know, and, like, the health of his family life. Whereas in Primer, They set out to travel through time for profit, which feels like a very, like, sort of post 9/11, like, people are corrupted by power aspects. But before we get too far into that, I think that this is as good a place as any for a break. So we will take it. Back in a jiffy, dear listeners. Welcome back. I hope you enjoyed that short break as much as we did. We were collecting our thoughts on sort of the way that Primer works and also the way it makes us feel. So what are the other of you feel comfortable sort of talking a little bit about the plot of Primer?
I can't, well, so maybe you should do it since you've seen it a couple of times, but, or let's do it combined.
Sounds good.
Let's do it that way.
That way we can all fill it in, because it is like, it's a confusing mess of timelines.
I mean, it's a pretty short movie, but it covers, essentially, it starts out and you're seeing Aaron, and I can't remember the other guy's name.
Abe,
that's right. And they are planning with their friends. You don't really know exactly what they're planning, unless you kind of know what the movie's about. But you see them at their kitchen table. Aaron's wife is kind of, like, doing the dishes, so they clearly have just had dinner. You see them kind of in the garage fiddling around with a few things.
Yeah.
And trying different things.
Those, you know, things you sort of imagine engineers do. Like they just get together and do science on their off time also.
They do a lot of that.
I think what I read online is that they have, like, they're network engineers by day. And then in the evenings they do a scrappy little business, like, selling, like, rehabbed, like, motherboards and things. Like, you see them, like, with a soldering gun and stuff.
Or card, like,
that's it. Like, a PG card or something like that. I forget.
Yeah.
Sorry, listeners, if any of you are nerds of that style.
So it's not, like, it's not the side job that they all hoped it would be.
Yeah.
But then only two of them get involved in the actual plot. They sort of are dicks to the other two for the rest of the film.
Yep.
Yeah, that's pretty true. they essentially, there's a casual discovery. What's kind of great is they're always wearing, like, not suit and ties, but, like, dress shirts and ties for the most part through most of the movie.
Yeah.
But they make this discovery, Abe and Aaron do, and they kind of figure out there might be something like time travel, but it's kind of very mysterious. And then all of a sudden, Abe decides to take Aaron, kind of, they go out on a drive, and they end up near this storage facility, and Abe's kind of like, don't freak out. and then...
I'm not tricking you, I'm not an asshole. Like, you know, this isn't a joke.
And then you see Abe, another Abe, going into the storage facility.
With an oxygen tank, which is
with an oxygen tank. And they've been talking about...
Fascinating.
Yeah, that was really interesting, actually.
Right, like, I like the way that Shane Carruth, as a writer and a filmmaker, respects the audience enough sometimes to leave you with questions.
Yeah.
But you, like, have this, like, vague idea of how the time travel is working, and you have a vague idea of why these parts are important. You know, and he's like, you're smart enough, either fill it in or go with the flow. It's a really interesting sort of approach to filmmaking in a time when I think we've all been sort of oversaturated with films which go out of their way to explain advanced mythologies to us.
Oh, yeah. Well, even basic.
Or even really basic stuff. They're just like, well, you might not know exactly what this is, so we have to demonstrate.
Here's an awkward scene with two people explaining everything to you and an audience proxy.
Completely unnecessary.
Never happens in Primer.
I'll discuss, that would never happen in any Shane Carruth movie.
Nothing in the plot actually happens in the movie.
There's never going to be a point at which something is explained. I will talk about this later on, but I saw the movie 42, and it was such a weird, I actually really liked a lot of it, but it was very weirdly the opposite of a Shane Carruth movie in that so many basic things were explained, even the rules of baseball. And I was like, why would you go see a baseball movie without knowing, like, basic things? to be able, like, you can follow what's whether or not something is good or bad. Anyway.
Also, is it possible to not know even the basics of baseball? Like, I wish I didn't. I really don't like baseball at all. But
also, you can't figure it out by context and by, like, a crowd's reaction to something. Right? Oh, this is good, or this is bad.
Right? It's like anyway. An episode of the IT Crowd, like, oh, he's kicked the ball.
Yeah, pretty much.
Kicked it again. Like,
but... To loop it back to Primer.
Loop, sorry.
No, it's okay.
Shane Carruth coincidentally consulted on Looper.
Did he really?
Yeah.
I love that. Okay, we're going to go back to that later. Anyway, so what happens is they start, so Abe then starts to show Aaron what to do, and he says that the machine that they've created, which is a bigger version of what was in the garage, is a one-time use machine, essentially.
And what he means by one-time use is that you can only do one timeline over once. Like, or it's implied that you can only do one day over one time. So, I'm not sure if, like, at some point in the film, like, I think we see him travel back to, like, punch that dude in the face. And that seems like a long time ago, but I don't really know anymore.
Well, he talks about it, but, like, I don't know if we ever establish whether that happens.
Yeah.
No, I think
like
show...
so many things that they talk about happening in this film.
Because I think in the montage sequence we see him go to a party and punch someone in the face.
Yeah, well, we see him stop. So essentially, what? Okay, here's this. Maybe this is some of the background we should go over. In the beginning of the movie, they talk about getting funding for their company.
Yeah.
But they need this girl, Rachel's dad. Rachel is super into Abe.
Yeah.
And so they use kind of like Rachel's infatuation with him to a certain extent. To gain access to her father in order to get funding for their company. So Rachel comes up kind of later on in the movie again. But essentially, they start kind of going back in time, but you can only go back like six to eight hours or something like that, or that's how
you
much
can
they,
only go
they
back
tend to go back.
Like, since the machine has been turned on.
Yes.
Yes. So, like, they'll turn on the machine... Then they wait 6 hours and try not to interact with the world, like, at any point in time.
Yeah.
And then they also kind of, as they go along, as they're doing this repeatedly, they're researching stocks and figuring out what they should be investing in. Right. So they see what happens with the stock market later on in the day. And then they climb into the box with the oxygen tank and fall asleep. For 6 hours, I guess.
I
and then
like
it takes
them
back. I
feel like they were really cryptic about the oxygen tank, but the box is one with argon to make it work, and you can't breathe argon, you'll die. So that's what the oxygen tank is for.
Good catch,
I honestly
Nissa.
Had not actually caught on to that. So
I just thought that the box was somehow contained in such a way that you needed to, like, have, like, an oxygen tank.
That's what I thought, too.
To me, it was just, like, basically
like
a magic box.
They were building it to reverse gravity, and I guess they were creating negative pressure by using argon in some way.
Yeah. So they, end up, investing in, they're getting a bunch of, a buttload of money, kind of, and they're, but then they, Aaron starts to kind of get a little weird in terms of, they hear about Rachel's boyfriend bringing a gun to the party. It's unclear to me whether or not he shoots her.
Yeah.
Does he shoot her? Is that the
thing
that happens?
I think that they go back and they correct it.
He just comes in with the gun. Like, at no point does he shoot anyone, because they have an argument about this, about whether or not their lives are in danger.
I thought it's because the boyfriend caused harm that he's saying, you can't, this is what Primer does to people, by the way.
Yeah.
But, I think it's the, I interpreted it as he caused some kind of harm because Abe is saying, you can't risk your life for Rachel.
Mm.
And so the implication is that something must have happened to her in order to cause him to want to go back to stop it.
No, he wants to go back to be the hero of the party to, like, get the funding, basically. And also because he's a dick. The guy just comes in with the gun and, like, never actually, because they have this argument.
Okay.
When Abe is saying, like, you can't go back, you know, you can't risk your life, and it's just because he has a gun that, like, is loaded sometimes.
At least one of the
iterations, like, it's loaded. But he's saying, like, he never fired it when I wasn't there, he didn't fire it the first time, he did try to fire it when I rushed him that time, like...
But anyway, it becomes clear to Abe... through the course of Aaron's actions that he's becoming increasingly unstable and he's using the device increasingly for personal gain and in ways that Abe doesn't approve of. So at that point, we realize that Abe has a fail-safe machine, which has been on the entire time. So he can go back, he thinks, and stop time travel from ever happening.
Right.
But,
which is a smart thing to do when you think about it.
It was a good idea.
But then we discover that Aaron already always knew about the failsafe machine, and it built...
Right, and has built his own that starts earlier, so he always has control of the time.
Exactly. And so there's a series of montage scenes with basically the two of them struggling through time. And at the end of the film, it becomes abundantly clear that Aaron has won when we see him over... He's overseeing the construction of a time machine box the size of a building.
Yeah.
And that is Primer.
We assume that that's what it is.
It's totally what it is.
Yeah.
I'm like, why does it need to be this big? What are we moving?
There's also...
Well, they did talk about making him, like, the size of jumbo jets.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they do talk about... The thing that we haven't talked about is Aaron also controlling... Because what we really discover, actually, about the box... is that it's not really, is this something we want to talk about now?
Yeah, go.
That it's not really time travel so much as, I mean, it is, but you also create yourself a double.
Yeah.
Right.
And so,
well,
there are actually
whenever you're
going to
exist in the same time period, like, there's going to be two.
Yeah.
And that's why it's so important that you lay low.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's like, it's the idea that as soon as you turn on the machine, your double exits.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it's kind of, it gets kind of confusing, because essentially, yes, even though it is time travel, there's basically just always two of you at the same time. So it also becomes kind of this weird evil twin story.
Yeah.
Especially with Aaron, who really is a total asshole.
He even gets, like, a beard later on.
Yeah, yes.
I love his evil beard. Oh.
The more
scruffy
beard there is,
evil
the
twin.
More evil he is.
Sexy.
Sort of like eyeliner.
Yeah.
No, beards slash goatees are the male equivalent of eyeliner.
It's true.
Yeah, they are.
It's true. The more that exists, the more evil that person
is. Except in Star Trek The Next Generation, when Riker growing his beard is just 100% him becoming more awesome.
Yeah. Well, Riker's always the exception to the rule.
That was my sexy pigeon coup for William Riker.
What Aaron ends up doing is essentially poisoning his original... Is that correct?
Yeah.
He's the double. He poisons his original and then puts him up in the attic, which is hinted at because kind of early on in the movie, his wife keeps talking about how she wants to call in an exterminator because she thinks they have rats.
Instead, it's scurrying doubles.
Scurrying double instead upstairs, which I do love the... And how he keeps being like, I don't want to call an exterminator. And you're like, it's because you don't want to kill yourself.
Yeah,
but I don't understand why not. Like, why does this not cause more problems to just, like, have a bunch
of...
Well,
ultimately, though, he winds up with, like, a little army of Aarons. And, like, they wind up united in their purpose against Abe and, like, their desire to make profit. And they basically do his, like, minion work.
I think it's also this idea, like, as much as... I mean, I love the movie, Prestige, but the idea of killing your own double, which is essentially killing yourself, is a really difficult thing, I would imagine, for anyone to wrap their head around psychologically. Even though he poisons them, like, they know they're not going to die from,
like,
it.
If you're already, like, ninja poisoning somebody and going around, like, legit fucking up the world just so you can make some money, like, I feel like killing a version of yourself that isn't actually you, doesn't really present a moral quandary anymore.
I'm sorry, because that was just so cold-blooded, dude. Like, that was so tough. Like, that was so, like, if I were...
I think if I were already this big of a douchebag, like, it's not actually you that's dying, so what do you care?
It is, though, kind of. Like, it's, like, in The Prestige, when... What's his face? Is like drowning himself over and over in tubs with, and keeping his drowned bodies in a drowned body warehouse.
But it's always a new one doing it to the old one.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
in that
that's
case,
true, I guess.
It's always...
Well, he has all the memories of it happening and he remembers drowning every time.
He does, but that's the whole thing is like
horrible.
That's in that movie, that's how you know that he's past the point of redemption.
It's
because
true.
He's doing this. So I feel like we're still supposed to, up until, like, those last moments when you kind of realize everything that's happened, you're supposed to almost empathize with Aaron the whole time. Like, that he's the one who kind of, like, you feel like you'd kind of do some of the similar things. Like, you'd want to be the hero at the party. Then you would want to go back and make a bunch of money. It's supposed to be kind of that idea of what... what the everyday plebe would do with time travel.
I accidentally discovered time travel, so I'm going to make a shit ton of money. You know?
Like, yeah. Anything makes more sense to me than being the hero of the party thing. That just seems so dumb and, like,
it's
petty and short-sighted.
Well, why don't you just go kill your
waste
duplicate?
So many times of time.
But that's your thing, though, is, like, if you already know that you can make an unlimited amount of money, then wouldn't you get bored and you'd want to start... Then it becomes about emotional need, which is a big thing with Shane Carruth as well. He's very big on...
why does he need to be the hero of a party he didn't even go to in the first place? Like,
well, it's about the way we construct our own narratives, right? Like, so much about Primer is about two men trying in defiance of time to construct a positive narrative.
And that's why that fake word that he says when they're playing Scrabble the first day, evacipate, has developed an actual meaning related to the film.
Yeah.
Like, people have decided that it means, you know, rewriting your own history, like, or rearranging events to make yourself look better.
Well, I think it's really interesting because, in a way, it's like they're searching for that happy Back to the Future ending. I mean, why would you go back and try and change your parents' relationship? Like, why would you go back? It's not the petty thing that it is to being a hero at a party, but it's still an emotional need that you're satisfying.
Yeah, well,
and so it's very much about being, even winning, even getting a lot of money, I feel like, is very much about being the breadwinner in his family.
I mean, I suppose. Except he already was, but really.
But he's in a job, though, that, like, even his wife is kind of, well, sorry, Lindsay.
No, don't worry. I was just going to say, what's interesting about Primer is that it's about men accidentally stumbling onto the power of time travel and then using it for personal gain, like using it very deliberately. Whereas with Back to the Future, one of the things that's very interesting about it is that they discover it very deliberately, like Doc has like gone to all these efforts. But then the fact that they choose this time during which something important is happening with his parents' relationship is almost coincidental, right?
Yeah.
Like it just has to do with when the lightning strike happened or whatever.
Yeah.
Like they like choose the date almost at random. Am I misremembering?
No, that's pretty much true, yeah.
So
he doesn't
then he just
know
happens to be there, and he
dance.
Happens to, like, be like, oh, well, I can correct this. Like, you know, like, it becomes essential to keeping him in history that he makes it better. So, I mean, it's just, there are such interesting counterpoints between the two films. How did you guys feel about the aesthetics of Primer? I thought it was maybe one of the strongest points of the film.
It's beautiful. I mean, the way it's shot.
The visuals were really strong, yeah.
And it's very, he uses the camera well to really emphasize, like, his themes, to emphasize who these characters are, which is really good. It's not something that most people really engage in as much with filmmaking nowadays. I feel like a lot of it is about, oh, this looks like a pretty shot.
Right.
Yeah.
I did get a little tired of the serialized and misordered jump cuts.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah.
Because it's just, like, I understand it's supposed to be disorienting and, like, the whole timeline thing. Like, I get it. But we did it so much.
Yeah.
The movie's not even that long.
It's funny because shortly after rewatching Primer, I went to the drive-in with some friends and I watched the Tom Cruise movie, Oblivion.
Oh, yeah.
Which
how
is
that?
It's definitely a return to form for him. It's a really easy to watch, really fun science fiction romp.
I've heard really good things about it.
It was really fun. And it was like a perfect drive-in movie. And it's so refreshing because it's a little slower paced. Like, the film doesn't really open in medias res the way we've gotten used to it. Like, in the middle of, like, you're in the middle of the post-apocalypse. You're in the middle of a battle. Like, it takes the time to build the story. And then there is a kind of reveal at the end, but it's much more traditional storytelling than I've become accustomed to in modern times. And I would say that my one beef, maybe, with Carruth, and it's not really a beef you get to have with him as a filmmaker. My beef, actually, with, like, modern... experimental films of this style is that I get exhausted sometimes.
Yeah.
Like, I get tired of piecing it together, and I know that it's creative, and I know that it's cool, but at this point... And Primer was released in 2004, so it's not to blame for this at all. Like, it's the movies that have happened in succession following Primer. But I just... Sometimes I miss being told a story, and you don't really get that in Primer in the same way you get it in more traditional films.
I think
that was my biggest thing about it. Like, I'm having difficulty deciding to like it because, like, I understand that it's a piece of art, but it's not the kind of art that I want out of a movie. Like, I want a movie to tell me a story.
I can see that.
And there's no story here. Like, it's a character. I mean, things happen, obviously.
Yeah.
But, like, most of them don't happen on screen. It really reads more as, like, a sort of comment on what would otherwise have been a character study, but we don't even get that much information about them. It's just sort of like, hey, this is a thing, and these guys are sort of stand-ins for all sorts of stuff. I'm like, that's not what I want you to tell me a story, and I want it to be clear and have parts and have an end and, like, have a point. And this felt like it didn't have a point.
I can see that. I watched, like, the first time I watched the movie, I watched it, and it had been suggested by my friend Pat, and Pat was like, this movie's gonna fuck with your mind. Do you like David
well,
Lynch? You're going to love this. And so I do love David Lynch. So I did enjoy it. I enjoyed it even more on second watching. I think largely because I find the themes to be really honest. Like, this feels like a more honest assessment of what would happen if we mastered time travel. Like, on a small scale. Like,
it does function as an explanation for why time travel hasn't happened, because if it has, this is what happened, and, like, we really don't want that.
You know, like, everyone's just, like, fucking up everyone else's timelines, like, everyone else is just messing around, it becomes a power struggle, and, like, you know, like, also as an assessment of the ways in which power corrupts in relationships.
Yeah.
I think it was really interesting, and, you know, like, having just seen Upstream Color, I know that it was a lot about, like, betrayals of trust that occur, too. So I would say I really enjoyed Primer, but I think it's because I walked in and I didn't expect it to make any sense.
Yeah. I think I'd heard enough about it to know that it's not going to make sense, so I was actually surprised by how much of the movie was coherent to me.
Yeah.
Because I was told... I know that sounds weird, but, like, I was told you're going to have to watch this movie 3 or 4 times in a row to understand anything that's happening in it. And I was like, oh, God, that sounds so confusing. For me, though, watching, like, the first, it was only the last maybe 10 minutes of the movie where I was like, wait, what happened? The whole rest of it, I was like, okay, I get this. This is easy to follow.
Right.
This isn't a problem
for me. But then
the last 10
minutes, you're like, now, wait a minute. Now the entire rest of the movie doesn't make sense.
Which I kind of like. I have the thing of, I like that both types of movies exist.
Yeah.
I like that if I want to be challenged, I can pick this kind of movie. However, I don't understand people who, like, dislike the fun movies as well.
Yeah.
Like, I know a lot of people who are kind of like, oh, I hated this movie. It's such a big studio budget movie. And I was like, yeah, sometimes I want that. Sometimes
most
I want to go and be like,
and have no
explosions. Like, that's all I want sometimes.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's like, just, I think ultimately, like, the worst part of what's occurred in sort of, we're living in a very polarized culture right now.
Yeah.
So, like, in the 70s, like, big studios were cranking out art films all the time.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like, it's the endorsement of, like, Hollywood that allows, like, you know, it's like a great equalizing thing. Like, the big, like, blow-up explosion movie makes enough money that you then get a little beautiful jewel box movie that maybe doesn't make sense. And it's, all of that is
like
really important.
Less and less with studios these days, which is disappointing.
Yeah.
But, that's sort of the general idea.
Everything's become really derivative, and... I really, like, the reason I think Primer is so good and so important, more so than that I enjoy it, is that it challenges, instead of resting on our ideas about time travel to make an easy film, it does a film that's entirely different, that, like, does explain, to a degree, the method of time travel, which is fascinating, and then sort of delves into parts of it that we've never seen explored before.
Right. I did appreciate, like, I really liked the mechanic of time travel that
we
did here. Like, that you have to wait the amount of time that you want to relive. Like, you know, I feel like that's a thing we haven't done before.
No.
It's always sort of an instantaneous, like, actual traveling instead of, like, here, sit in this waiting room that you built that's full of poisonous noble gases.
Yeah.
Like,
also, the fact that you can't just, like, it's not like you get in the box and it's instantaneous either. Like, it's not just that you have to wait the amount of time that you want to go back, but also that you can't just, like, suddenly get in the box and then you're randomly back there. You then have to,
like, you
sleep
have to
for that amount of same amount of time.
Yeah.
It has to have been on, like, you have to be in there. Like.
And the other thing I liked about the movie is that even though you do have a few other characters in it, it's essentially a two-man show. Right, like, it's really like watching a play in so many ways, and I
really
enjoyed that
like it.
About it. And I just think it's really original, and we don't. I know that that's not really a phrase. It's original, and that's what makes it cool. It's a very novel, and I'm always excited to see new ideas, especially when things keep getting remade.
And I do respect that about it.
So did you guys want to take a break?
Yeah, sure.
And then when we come back, we're going to be comparing Primer to everyone's favorite time travel film, Back to the Future. And we'll be back to you, dear listeners, very soon. Welcome back. Still lingering here in the jungle of death with you. And we're going to have a talk right now about how Primer measures up, literally in terms of numbers, against everyone's favorite sci-fi time travel romp, Back to the Future, the first film. So I'm gonna read you guys some stats, and then we can talk about it. So the first one is budget-wise. Primer cost $7,000 to make. And it made back at the box office $424,760. That's 60 times its original budget.
Right.
Back to the Future, even in 1980, whatever, I think it was 85, cost $19 million to make. It made $383 million worldwide, which is 20 times its budget. But I just think it's really interesting how much, like, the margin on Primer is so much better. I can't imagine that when they were making this film they expected to make that much money, and it's still under $1 million. Like, it's the entire
$500,000, like, let's be honest.
Under $10,000. I mean, that's insane.
It's crazy.
No, the money they made.
Yeah, but
I see what you're saying. So
the crazy part is that Primer made so much money, but it was still so much less than the budget of the standard Hollywood film at this point. Like, when people talk about small films, like, for instance, the other day I was looking up District 9 for some reason. District 9, everyone was like, oh, well, he's going back to his roots. I'm speaking now of Peter Jackson. He's making a small movie, and it was still $10 million.
I found out it was actually $30 million.
Yeah,
When they talk about micro-budget movies... Like, the studios now are always searching for micro-budget movies. This is, like, a big thing. Or at least for a while they were. That was kind of the trend, which is something that can be made, typically they say, like, under $5 million. But usually it's for something, a micro-budget is usually something around, like, $15,000 that can be made. They're always wanting to see if something can be made for that low amount of money because their return is going to be so much higher.
So much higher.
It's really difficult, though, which I think Primer proves, to make a movie that's really good. Not that it's difficult to make a movie that's really good, but it's difficult to get the word out about a movie that is so micro-budget sometimes when you don't have big studio backing. Because this movie came out in 2004, and while it made a lot of money, it was very much in limited release. I hadn't heard of it for the longest time. I didn't hear about it until, like, maybe 2 years ago.
I agree. Watched Primer for the first time, I think, 2 or 3 years ago myself. And up until then, I'd never heard about it at all. But it's one of my favorite movies. I will say this about Primer. It's one of my favorite movies to recommend to people that's available on Netflix streaming. Right?
Oh, yeah.
Like, when someone's like, I need a movie to watch, like, what would you suggest? It's 70 minutes. We're going to talk about that in a second. But it's a very short film. It's, it's stylistically very interesting. And you wind up, it's just a perfect recommendation movie. It gets a conversation started. You know, like, whether or not people like it, it's fun for them to talk about.
Well, it's interesting because it feels like such a choice for Shane Carruth, like, because we were talking about Upstream Color a little bit offline, and how he chose to use all of his money from Primer to make Upstream Color because after going through all the big studio budget deals, he was realizing that he wasn't going to have any creative control. And he's really, like, made this effort to... it's just really interesting, kind of in contrast to things that were going on this week. Speaking of Zach Braff raising $2 million on Kickstarter for his movie, which was the remaining funding that he needed. He had full financing, actually, but was not going to be able to retain creative control. the thing, though, that's really interesting is, like, Zach Braff, apparently, which I did not realize, somebody crunched the numbers, is, like, a multimillionaire.
Yeah.
So instead of using his own money to fund the movie and then thus retain creative control,
right.
Like, Shane Carruth, we were talking about, is so broke because he's using all of his money to fund his films. He's,
right.
like, and he hasn't done, like, Kickstarter, he hasn't done crowdfunding, at least not to my knowledge.
No.
Like, at all,
right.
And yet he's making these amazing films with beautiful visuals and really interesting messages, and a really interesting take on filmmaking that I feel like a lot of people really appreciate. But he's doing it flat broke. Like,
yeah.
The poor guy is just, like, struggling to get by, and you have people like Zach Braff who are, you know, kind of,
he's in syndication. He's never he's never going to need money again in his life. Scrubs is going to be on TV forever, and
yeah.
he will get a check every
yeah.
time it's played. And it's become I mean, to me, it's like the question of the way rich people manage money as opposed to the way poor people manage money. The way rich people
yeah.
stay rich and leave wealth to their children as opposed to the way poor people, like, you know... to me, it's about the economic disparity in America right now. If I'm,
yeah.
like, looking at the two of them and the way that they're taking care of this business. Because, like, I think that if Shane Carruth did a Kickstarter, he would have gotten the money. But I think that
yeah.
he's making a choice, maybe, about it. That he doesn't even want to be,
right.
like, have that aspect of, like, a crowd control. Because, like,
mm-hmm.
you know... with Kickstarter, everyone now expects these bonuses when you invest in a project. It's
well, right, that's what
that.
I was just thinking, like, is it even feasible for somebody on such a small budget to do Kickstarter? Because, you know, how are you going to fund the, you know, the
perks.
Awards or whatever they call them? Yeah, the, like, bonuses you get for donating
yeah.
or whatever. Like, on the one hand, like you say, you gave $25 to Veronica Mars for a t-shirt. Like,
mm-hmm.
that's a $25 t-shirt in, you know, for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like,
well,
so if you know, you've got $7,000 to make a movie, or if you need
yeah.
like,
I agree.
Where are you going to get the money to make t-shirts or keychains or, like,
and you
fly people out
yeah.
to be in your movie? Or
his time is precious, too, and I think he knows that. And,
yeah.
like,
yeah.
He doesn't have a staff of thousands, you know, like,
yeah.
or, like, 20, so.
Yeah.
Well, I think the only thing that it could
yeah,
possibly benefit from.
A minute and a half.
Yeah. I think the only thing it could possibly benefit from, and this is literally the only thing that I'm really seeing in terms of those bonuses that's just occurred to me now, is DVD copies that would get spread out around
yeah.
and get more and more exposure for the film.
That's
the only thing I can really see as being the benefit of it, is getting, and not that he's seeking exposure, but in terms of, he talks about how he wants...
that's the point of an artist, though.
Yeah.
He wants people to be able to see it, and he wants people to not... He wants, like, a certain type of person to be able to see it. So I feel like... But I mean, like, people who can't necessarily... Because it's hard to explain, but, like, in L.A., he could have very easily probably had this showing at the Arclight. And the Arclight is where everybody in Hollywood goes to see movies. There's a bar, there's food. It's a big experience. People love to go out at the Arclight, and it's, like, a big deal, and a lot of indie movies get shown there. And it's a $17 or $18 ticket.
Right.
That's a really...
Well, I see what you mean by a certain kind of person.
Yeah, like, people who can't...
I was thinking you meant, like, you only wanted people who were smart enough. Or
yeah.
Like,
oh, no. People
movie.
Of a certain economic class
yeah,
to be able to see the movie.
Yeah, because he made a point of having it released in Atlanta, which isn't known as, like, a hotbed of... like, where you send your art movie
yeah.
to get more exposure. And he actually, I went and saw it yesterday at, we have this awesome theater, it's called The Plaza, and it's actually run by a nonprofit organization.
Nice.
And it's a historic theater. And yes, Rob Zombie's The Lords of Salem was playing downstairs, so he occasionally had a backtrack that you wouldn't have expected for Upstream Color. But it was still, like, awesome to be able to just go out and see it. Increasingly, like, people are releasing their movies in Atlanta because Atlanta is growing in, you know, it's growing in the relevance of it as a city is being acknowledged
value.
On the national stage. Like,
yeah.
people realize that it's a place that can, like, does have artistically minded people that will pay to see these things. But it was great. The feeling of community when I walked into the Upstream Color screening was so great. Like, it was, like,
yeah.
Lewis and me and, like, seven other couples, and we were all just like, yeah. Yeah, we're watching Upstream Color. Yeah, we're watching it at the Plaza.
Yeah.
You're like, and it's the upstairs theater, as I mentioned, and it just smells like 70s smoke and, like, old carpet and, like, that old theater smell. It's, like, kind of like a library, but more popcorn-y. And I just, I can't. It was great. It was great. And Shankaroo, on the off chance that you'll ever listen to this podcast, I want to say thank you so much for putting your movie in Atlanta. I really appreciate it.
That's awesome.
Another interesting sort of comparison to make between these two films is their length in minutes. Primer is 78 minutes long, which, if you do the calculations, is $1,000 per 10 minutes, or $100 per minute, I guess. No. Somebody do that math for me.
I don't know.
Back to the Future is 116 minutes.
Yeah, it's like $100 a minute.
It's a 116-minute movie. So it's got 40 more minutes to tell a story than Primer. When you're watching these two movies, though, I think that, if I'm honest, I feel like Primer is longer. Like, it is action-packed, but it's stressful in such a way that there's a slight crawl.
It's more exhausting. Like, it's harder work.
Yeah, you have to pay attention to it. It's working your brain. Back to the Future, you sit there, and you're just like, that 116 minutes just rolls by. But yeah, I mean, it's just, it's interesting what they did with the time they had to tell a story, I think.
Well, and I think that also it's really probably also a choice in that he knows this is an exhausting subject. To make the movie longer, not only would it have cost him more money, but it's also that thing of it would be really hard, I feel like, for the audience to sit through more than what it was.
Oh my lord, can you imagine if this movie was like 2 hours long?
It would be really difficult, because at that point you would get really tired of the conceit, I feel like, and you would, this gives you that
feeling.
I think
at that point there would have been no, like, I'm trying to, you know, decide to like it. I would have just, like,
yeah, you would have been like, I hate this movie.
Can everyone,
But it's definitely something where, because it can lull you, because it's short enough, it can lull you into that false sense of security where you're like, oh, this is a movie I totally understand, and I know exactly what's happening in every single second of this film. And then all of a sudden, at the end of it, you're like, wait, what?
Yeah.
And it's just enough that you really do feel like the rug's been pulled out from under you, and you don't, all of those things that you would normally maybe pick up on in a longer film and be like, oh, that was a weird moment. Because you're getting bored and you're looking for differences. That doesn't happen. You're kind of sucked in to it, I feel like.
Yeah, I feel like, especially since I did go back and try and watch it again yesterday, and, like, well, I mean, I did attempt, I succeeded in watching like, I was trying to look for, like, hints, because I had read, you know, an article that Lindsay sent me about the movie, and, like, I was looking at charts and things, and so I was trying to look for hints about, like, how to tell what the hell's going on. Which, it turns out, is impossible. And you just can't see it. Like, you're trying so hard to understand what's being shown to you that you really can't, you don't have any extra processing power to try and figure out what else is going on. If there is more hint happening, you just don't have the processor to deal with it. Like, it's not, there's no space.
I agree. I also, you know, sort of to conclude, I wanted to talk about the differences in the themes and the feelings you walk away with. Like, the key one, you know, you could sort of summarize the plot of Primer by saying that there are two engineers, and they become time travelers in order to make money.
For fun and profit.
Whereas in Back to the Future, you have a teen and a mad scientist traveling back in time to change the past in such a way that it improves the future. There's, when you read those two things against each other, there's a lot of, I think, cynicism in the first that wasn't there, maybe when the second, I'm sorry, there's a lot of cynicism in Primer that maybe didn't exist at the time Back to the Future was made. And I think that sort of as a reflection of our time, Primer is a time travel movie for our generation, which makes me a little sad. Right?
Well, it's weird because I think it's the idea of, like, what we grew up on. And I always talk about this and how so many people I know do what they want to do on the side. There's that Onion article that was kind of the joke that I think we've talked about before, but the find what you love to do and then do it on the weekends and at night. And it's, I think that's very much a thing that our generation does, because we were raised during a time where we were told you can do anything, you can be anything you want to be.
Right.
You know,
and it turns out
things.
That's not true.
Well, not only like, that, but yeah. We came of age during an economic recession, so that,
yeah. You
know, even if we had the opportunity to do those things before, now we don't. Now that's not really an option. And
right. You
have to take that day job because that's the only thing that's going to be able to fund. Like, you have student loans now. Now you have all of these
right. Financial
responsibilities
you need
that you
help
might
insurance.
Not have had before.
Yeah.
What was that?
You need health insurance. You need to
yeah. Pay
for your apartment. You need,
right. Like,
you just come to realize, and I mean,
well,
again, that's part of the reason Primer feels so honest to me in some ways. Like, how much
yeah. Of
your adult life is spent thinking about money,
yeah. Whether
or not you ever wanted to.
And it's that scene where he talks about how he just wants to punch his boss in the face.
Yeah.
And how, like,
yeah. His
wife and Abe are so happy for him to have that thought. That I feel like that idea of, like, how we defend our bosses and how we defend our, like, the companies we work for.
Well that we rationalize the hideous situations
yeah. We
get stuck in. Like,
yeah, no, absolutely. And it was just really interesting, the idea that never at any point in time was he like, we're going to make so much money, I'm going to quit my job. He was like, I want to punch my boss in the face. There was never
right. A
moment where it felt like he was like, I'm going to quit my job.
Yeah.
Because that felt like too crazy a thing for them to do.
Right,
yeah.
That's too far.
It's
like, time travel and punching the dude in the face, that will...
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a step too far to actually not have to have a job.
A friend's lady friend recently quit her job. And it was honestly, like, I just had... It had been... I don't think I've ever heard of anyone in my adult life just quitting their job because they were dissatisfied with it.
Yeah,
and I just,
right.
I was
the thing
just, like,
you can't do.
I was filled with this sense of empowerment. Like, because
yeah. She'd
done it? Anyway, so, yeah.
It's great, yeah.
It's crazy to think about. But having seen Upstream Color, I'd say it's a much more positive, in some ways, piece from Shane Carruth. So I'd really encourage
yeah. You
both to see it at some point.
Absolutely.
And listeners, I'd encourage you to get on your Netflix and check out Primer, because whether or not you like it, it's going to make you think.
Yep.
Did you guys have any
That's
other
true.
Thoughts? I feel like we're at a... good closing point here.
We are, I think. I don't think there's anything else I was going to add. No, that was it. Yeah, that was
well,
it.
Yeah, I feel like I mostly covered my bases there.
I agree.
Yeah.
I think that we all had solid points to make, and thank you so much.
So much like this film, it ends up being quite short.
Thank you, listeners. Thank you, Shane Carruth, for the awesome piece of art, and we'll see you very soon again here in the Jungle of Death. Bye!
Bye!